Well, I didn't bring any slides, so you saw all the slides that I may be talking about, and so I don't need any. Well, this is the end of a very good conference. There was lots of discussions, and it was a very lively conference. And so the first thing I want to do is to thank different addresses, and in the first place the Institute and the staff of the Institute who gave us excellent services. We didn't have to go and look for restaurants. I would also like to thank all the speakers in the name of the organizers and all the participants who came here. And in particular, I would like to thank Miguel Ortuno for doing the major work in organizing the conference. He did a marvelous job, and I want to thank him actually also for something else personally. And that is to give me the last word at the conference. I normally never get the last word anywhere, so that's a nice break. Okay, so now I should go to summarizing the conference. What I want to do is to bring up mainly things that are still open questions, that turned out to be open questions that came up during discussions and also during some talks, including some relevant things that came up during the program on electron glasses, of which this conference is a part. So I think it's better to go home and think about open questions than take home things that everybody knows about already, which are settled. So let me list the topics of the conference pretty much in the order took the fraction, the major fractions of the time of the conference. And so the two probably major topics in that sense were Josephson. Devices. Which are hopefully going to lead to quantum computation. So the purpose of the discussion or of working on them, the main purpose was quantum computation. Then electron glasses, probably comparable time, was spent on talks about electron glass, and then some effects due to disordered magnetism. Then superconductor insulator transition. It Oops. And then the variety of other subjects. So I should mention that I'm not an expert on all these subjects, if on any at all, actually. And so if I say something that's wrong, I hope people in the audience will correct me. And if I know very little about the subject and I can get to it, I'll ask some volunteers from the audience who know much more about it than I do. All right, so I'll take this in order of appearance because, they, like I said, most of the time was spent on this subject. And so let me start with Josephson Qubit. The problem, of course, with Josephson qubit for quantum computation is that in order to be useful for quantum computation, one must keep some eigenstate in the device for a very long time without degradation, without dephasing. And it turns out that there are many culprits who deface the state in the qubit, which were mentioned during some of the talks. But there are two which were definitely identified, and the two are two-level systems in the junction, and the fluctuation of the two-level systems since the junction can be represented by an inductance. The TLS is coupled to the inductance and that defaces the state of the system, of course. The other culprit, which is definitely identified, are spins on the surfaces of the metal. So one, of course, aims to minimize their number, their density, or cheat them out of being active in some way or another. And that becomes a problem to a large degree of material science and engineering. So the two-level systems in the junction are probably of unknown origin, but the major study was to find a material, a dielectric material, an insulator, which is relatively free or as free as possible of the two-level systems. And many materials have been tried, both amorphous and crystalline. Of the amorphous ones, the best, so far at least, appears to be hydrogenated amorphous silicon, from what we heard. And presumably, this is a very good amorphous material because the hydrogens are binding the dangling bonds. As people who have worked for years on amorphous silicon tell us. And so perhaps then the TLS is something to do with the dangling bonds. In general, the crystalline materials are much better, are considerably better from what we saw than the amorphous materials in that respect. All right. So I think that's probably what I want to say about these devices. The main effort seems to be in finding good dielectrics for the Josephson junction. Now, the second culprit which has been identified are the spins on the surface, which I don't think anybody knows much about, and in fact they appear, it turns out, after some considerable studies, they appear at very high densities on almost every material, on metals and also on dielectrics. So it's roughly 10 to the 13 per centimeter squared. Now the spins, when they flip, they couple to the flux inside the device, and so that again dephases them, dephases the system, and shortens the time that one can keep a quantum state in the system. The question then is, one can see noise due to these spins, one sees noise. And there has been some theoretical work in the direction of whether, because of the very large number of spins on the surface, the large density in addition to the disorder, whether they bring about, whether these two things bring about sufficient frustration to generate a spin glass. Claire and her collaborators decided to do a theoretical study of the noise due to a spin glass, and found out that the noise which they saw in their theory, which I believe was a simulation, does correspond to the noise which is seen in the flux noise. Well, so let me go over to electron glass now, the second item on the list. And the first question is, well, what does one call an electron glass? An electron glass, by many people, is defined as an Anderson localized system of electrons, where the interactions, where the Coulomb interactions are important. Not everybody will agree on that, but that is the usual definition of an electron glass. So now there is a relatively large number of such systems where glassiness has been observed. Originally it started with granular gold by Atkins and his group, and then it was studied also in other material by Goldman and his group. And the most extensive study so far has been done on indium oxide, both amorphous and crystalline, by Ovadiahu and his group. Let me just say what the important features of the Glasiners are. Structurally, I mean, inherently, the important features are, of course, as of any glass disorder and interactions, in this case, Coulomb interaction, disorder. So disorder gives you the Anderson localization, and the interactions are the Coulomb interactions. Normally, one thinks of electrons as a very fast particle, a very light particle, and therefore very fast. And so one is surprised that it can form a glass, and I think there are still people who believe that that the glass that one sees in electron glasses is not inherent to the electrons, but perhaps comes from ions, from heavier particles that may be disordered. And the interaction of the electrons basically reads out the glassiness of the ions, so that something that one calls extrinsic glass that can happen. But I think there is now very good evidence that in many materials the electron glass is an inherent property to the electrons, in other words, an intrinsic glass. Much of the, probably the most important evidence for that is that some of the properties of the electron glass are determined only, experimentally determined only by the density of the electrons. So that is good evidence that in many of the materials where one sees electron glassiness, that it is an inherent property to the electrons. There is some other evidence also, but that's probably the most important one. So let me just briefly tell you what one thinks of as a glass and show you some experiments very briefly. So usually one thinks of glassiness as very slow relaxation, very slow non-exponential relaxation. And the other property that one thinks of is aging. Well, aging is also a term that not everybody will agree what it means, but to me at least, it means mainly a breaking of time homogeneity. Normally one thinks that an experiment depends only on the time. If I start an experiment at time t0, that it just depends on t minus t0. It turns out, as you will see, that and as you saw, of course, that this is not the case in an electron glass. The basic reason for it being non-ergodicity, that is, the glass never gets to equilibrium. It decays very, very slowly to equilibrium, and the internal state of the glass makes it respond in accordance to what that state turns out to be. So if I excite the glass and then it gradually decays to equilibrium very slowly, its internal state changes also, and what you see then, the experiment depends on the history of the glass, of what happened inside what it remembers from past times. Okay, so the two experiments which show you the slow relaxation are just exciting the system, and that most of the time there are many ways to excite the system, but one can excite it with changing a gate voltage in a MOSFET structure. And what one sees, if one waits a long time for the system to almost equilibrate and then puts on a delta function of the change of the gate voltage, so this is the gate voltage, VG, this is how VG goes, and the response to it is something like that, the G, so this is VG, this color here, VG, and the conductance goes as somewhere from some level, and here it jumps up because the system is excited, and then it decays gradually. Well, it decays towards the equilibrium value, and as you saw during the conference, this is a very good logarithmic function, a logarithm of time, and in some cases it has been seen for five orders of magnitude of time. If you replot it on a logarithmic scale, it becomes a straight line. The second experiment, so this is the experiment on the non-exponential very slow decay, and the experiment that an experiment, a possible experiment that the system remembers its history is the following experiment. Again, you take the gate voltage the way you did before at some time, then turn it on the way you did before, but then you take it back to its original value at TW. And the response, the conductance then behaves like this. Again, it goes up. And now the first part does exactly what this did. But now it starts doing something. It still decays slowly when you take back the gate voltage to its original value. So now if you consider this as the time t equals zero where you started the experiment and want to look at how this decays and see whether it depends on its history, which here you simply simulate by changing TW, you will see that it depends on TW. So now it depends not only on the T minus T zero, but it also depends on TW. And so this is breaking the homogeneity in time. Well, there is another experiment which is very important, and that is what is called memory dip experiment. So what you do there in the memory dip experiment is that again you let the system wait for a very long time, okay, very long time, measure the conductance, and then you sweep the gate voltage, you take it up and down. Well, let's say you sweep it up, and you can sweep it. So I sweep it in one direction, then I sweep it in another direction. And so what you see, the response to this kind of a change of the gate voltage looks like this. So if I go from the minimum in one direction, it will look like this. If I go in the other direction, it will look like this. And so this object is called the memory dip. It's called memory dip because when you come back from the excited state here, quickly enough, you will come back to almost the same position. Well, it turns out experimentally, I think, these two things are quite well understood. The logarithmic decay, as well as the aging experiment, and we heard a talk about it by Amir. So this is quite well understood and actually relatively simple to understand. On the other hand, this is not understood at all. The shape of that is not understood at all. And it turns out that it is a very universal property, as Zvi likes to emphasize. The shape does not depend on anything but temperature. So it doesn't depend on concentration, it doesn't depend on disorder, it doesn't depend on sweep rate. It can change its amplitude, but you can always scale it in such a way that you come back at the same temperature. You can scale it so that it doesn't depend on anything else but the temperature. And so that is a rather amazing discovery, which is not understood at all. So one really does not understand this feature of the glass, which is very universal. And I think one of the important things is to try to understand this feature, what it is. Okay. So this is about the experiments. And now let me go to the third item, which is the effects due to disordered magnetism. We've heard three lectures on it, or possibly four, and there are the following experiments. One was on magnetically, let me start with the first that we heard, and that's a magnetically doped semiconductor, which it turns out shows a huge, enormous magnetoresistance. So if you apply H and at zero H we have a resistance here, then at some relatively low, maybe something like a Tesla, you see an increase in the conductance. This is conductance now, by something like three orders of magnitude, which is really amazing. And so the question is, how do you explain such a thing? And the possible explanation Well, there are two possible mechanisms that were considered, and that's, by the way, this is an experiment by Hellman, I should say, who described it. So the magnetic impurity presumably generates a spin polaron around it. It is a spin and generates a spin polaron, and so now you have to move the spin polaron through the system. The system at the whole is just paramagnetic, so spins are oriented at random, and so it is difficult to make a polarized polaron move through random spin orientations. But if you put a magnetic field on it, you start polarizing the electrons, and so then the magnetic polaron can move much more easily. But some estimates of how much of an effect this can cause show that this is not a sufficient mechanism to explain such a huge change in magnetization. And what Hellman thinks is that actually you change the the level at which you get conduction, the mobility edge, in other words. And the reason that that happens is because if you magnetize the system in one direction, then that eliminates one type of disorder. And so if you change the disorder, you can move the mobility edge, of course. And she thinks that this is the mechanism. So when you don't have a magnetic field and the spins are not ordered, then you have a very disordered system. And when you apply a magnetic field, the disorder doesn't exist anymore, it's diminished, and therefore you get a change in the mobility edge. In any case, this is a very interesting system and should be studied further. The second disordered magnetic system was shown by Miriam Sarachik, and that is a system where you have very large molecules which are magnetic, and there is a dipole-dipole interaction, so it generates a local magnetic field. They generate the local magnetic field. Now it turns out that there is a preferred axis to these molecules, but the axis, it's a crystal, so the axis, there are several slightly different types of molecules where the tilt is somewhat different. And so there is a randomness a certain randomness in the local field due to the tilt. But what you can do is to apply perpendicular. What she does is apply a perpendicular magnetic field to the easy axis, and that generates more disorder because it tilts further the direction of the spin, and so that brings about some disorder which affects the magnetization, the magnetic properties. In particular, she showed hysteresis loops which were greatly affected by the magnitude of the field, of the perpendicular field. And the third experiment on random magnetic randomness of magnetism. Well, actually, she says that this is a realization of a random magnet. Random magnets are something a rarity. It's not easy to generate a random internal field in a system. But this is one system which acts as a random magnet. So the third experiment that we heard about on disordered magnetism was by Aviad Friedman on a granular nickel, and that is actually quite an interesting experiment because it turns out that the magnetic field, the internal magnetic field, has a very large effect on the relaxation time. Now, what one means by relaxation time, basically, without going into the detail of the experiment, it's an experimental time. So if you have the logarithmic decay here from some time where you start the experiment, it's essentially the time where you have a decay to half that amplitude, this amplitude. And this, by the way, is something. I should go back perhaps a bit to what Amir was telling us about the logarithmic dependence, and which also other people did, what it comes from are relaxation times, that the relaxation times between states go as e to the minus some random variable x, okay? So that x is generally, if you have a many particle system, that x is a certain length, which is a sum of Hopping distances, as we heard from in a recent talk by Somoza, and also an energy. Okay, so it doesn't matter what it is. The main thing is that this is a random variable. So if you calculate the distribution of the W, okay, the distribution of the W is basically 1 over W. And the distribution of the X itself comes just as a logarithmic correction, so that's some function of the logarithm of W. Okay, which doesn't change much, and so the only important part of this f of log w is that there is a cutoff. So as long as the distribution is smooth, it doesn't do much because it's just a logarithmic correction. But the important thing is that there exists a minimum w, a maximum tau, and so this gets cut off at some W min, and this is W min here. Okay, but so the experimental time tau is basically this time. So since it's a logarithm, then this time, the 1 over w minimum would be tau squared. But what I want to talk about is basically the measure tau, because this is what Aviad measures. And the interesting thing is that this tau changes by several orders, okay, changes by several orders of magnitude, by three orders of magnitude, by cooling the system down. And this is a very, very rapid change in temperature. It occurs through a very small interval of temperature. So what Aviad thinks is that it has to do with the ordering of the system as you lower the temperature from something that is super paramagnetic. These grains, the grains of the nickel, that's done in granular nickel, as I say. So the grains of the nickel are ferromagnetic. They are polarized. The spins there are polarized. But at high temperatures, the grains may be polarized, each one in some direction, but the direction is random. So in that sense, it's like it's paramagnetic. Below a certain temperature, it becomes ferromagnetic due to interactions between the grains, or perhaps in any case, the perhaps it's a spin glass more than a ferromagnet, but let's say that it's a ferromagnet. And so what happens is that actually it's an anti-ferromagnet. So the idea is that if we have this polarized spins here, and the conduction is by hopping from one spin to another, from one grain to another, that if these are parallel, it's very easy to jump from one to the other. And if they're anti-parallel, it's much more difficult to jump. And so when you come to something like an anti-ferromagnetic interaction in the system, then the jumping becomes much more difficult, and this W min is going to increase, and it turns out it increases by three orders of magnitude, by two orders of magnitude, sorry, with temperature. And when you apply a magnetic field, you can change it by another order of magnitude. The interesting thing is that while you change the W min, the conductivity hardly changes. The conductivity changes just by a few percent. And so there is not much of a connection. It shows you that there is some connection, but not much of a connection between the conductivity and the tau that you see, the decay time. This changes up to three orders of magnitude, and the conductivity changes only by a few percent. So, you know, this tau is determined by the W min, while the conductivity occurs somewhere by transitions in this region. And so the connection is kind of very distant between the two. On the other hand, if you change the, you can see that loose connection also by changing the temperature. If you change the temperature a little bit, then the conductivity changes a lot. It can change by orders of magnitude, but the tau hardly changes at all. So Well, this is conductivity versus log time. Sorry. So this is W min to the minus one here. This is tau max, okay, in this plot function. And this is this is resistivity, conductivity, right? G, they call it G. So the measurement goes only to here, okay. Well, it continues a little bit further, but what they measure is when it's at half this amplitude, basically. And so that changes by orders of magnitude, but the conductivity, when you look at the conductivity itself, it changes only by a couple of percent. So I think I got a signal that I have 1 minute, so I think I'll have to forget about these two things and I'll finish here. Somebody else can summarize it to himself. Anyway, so. Thank you very much for listening, and you can go home now. I should tell you that what is very close to my heart are the aging experiments, because I think I've been aging longer than anybody else at this conference. So I like these experiments very much. Anyway, so thank you very much for listening, and that's it.